Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 29. I'm recording it on Monday, October 20th, and stocks are today at a PE10 level of around 16-17, which is just a little bit above fair value, but stocks offer a fine long-term value proposition at today's prices. And the title of this podcast is There an Economic Depression in Your Future? This is disturbing subject matter. I don't like to talk about economic depressions because when you're talking about it, I talk about the downside of investing in overvalued stocks all the time. That's some people consider that a negative thing, and I do not. I consider that a positive thing in many ways, because when you understand how valuations affect long-term returns, you understand how to invest effectively for the long run, and that brings wonderful financial benefits into your life. So I don't view that as such a negative topic, but I do. There's a lot of emotionalism that surrounds it. There are a lot of people that get very heated when you talk about how valuations affect long-term returns, and that part I do find a downer. All the negativity and all the argumentativeness and the ugliness. But when you talk about a flat-out depression, you're talking about something that is all bad. There's no upside to an economic depression. We're talking about, when you talk about a depression, you're talking about the economy being destroyed. You're talking about people's lives being destroyed, and I feel I have to say, you're potentially talking about our system of government it being at least under threat of being destroyed. That's what happened in the 1930s. If you read history, we got through it. We got through it, but the risks were real, and of course. An argument can be made that the depression, which became worldwide, was a contributing factor to what happened in Germany, leading to World War II. So there's a part of me that resists even putting forward such a podcast. There's a part of me that would just prefer not to do it, not to go there, as the expression goes. But the other side of the story is, if we're going to go there at all, I would much rather go there in a podcast and go there in an effort to change people's thinking than to go there in real life. And if there's anything that my little mind can put forward that would help people to understand what we need to do to avoid an economic depression, then certainly there's a responsibility to go there, to make an effort to put those ideas forward and see if they can have any positive effect. So with those thoughts in mind, I will go there. I will take a shot at it. And I think the most direct way to do that, I always try to do several things in my writing in general and my writing on investing in particular. I always try to personalize it, to make it a story, and to make things as simple as I can while maintaining accuracy. But I do try to simplify because I think it's important that the average person be able to understand more about personal finance than most of us do today. And I will... To start talking about an economic depression and what we need to do to avoid it, I think the thing to do is to tell you the title of part one of the book. When I that I'm working on investing. I'm following the same pattern of organization for the second book that I used in my first book, Passion Saving. And that is, the book will have 12 chapters divided into three parts, four chapters in each part. And I give a name to each of the chapters, and I give a name to each of the parts. And I spend a lot of time on these chapter titles and these part titles. Organization is very big to me in writing a book. If you read my chapter titles, you essentially have an outline of the book itself. And I struggled over the chapter, the title that I used for part one for some time. I came up with a title that I felt was accurate, that I felt told the story that needed to be told effectively, but that seemed too far out for a while. I've gotten over it. I've gone with this title, and I've decided on going with this title sometime back, probably a year or two back at this point. But I thought the title was almost too controversial when the thought first occurred to me. And the title I am using for part one of my book on investing is Stock Drunk. Stock Drunk. And I, of course, ended up using that. If you go to my website, I ended up using those words as a section title at the website. Because once I made a decision to use it, I grew to like it. But it's in the face. Stock Drunk. I those words do a great job of looking at this thing I'm always talking about, passive investing, the investing approach that purports to be science. The investing approach that purports to have it all figured out, to have it all under control, to tell us all the answers. The investing approach that may not be questioned by mere humans, mere mortals. The investing approach of the gods. Passive investing was handed down to us like the Ten Commandments. It was handed down to us by God. And we should not question. We should not question the passive investing concept. The phrase stock drunk is a pretty darn direct question of all of that junk, isn't it? Because when I say that we are stock drunk, what I am saying is, I'm not just saying we're wrong, I'm not saying we are, even that phrase I use about the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, they got the number wrong. That's a little provocative. In relative terms, not nearly as provocative as stock drunk. Because saying they got the number wrong means people made a mistake. And that, of course, happens in the course of human events. But stock drunk? How could you more effectively challenge the claim that passive investing is a science than to say that passive investing has left us stock drunk? It has turned us into alcoholics. What could be less rational than an alcoholic? Someone who is deliberately, through deliberate act, throwing away his job, his money, his house, his wife, his family, his self-respect, his health. Stock drunk. That's what I believe we are. That's what I believe we are. That's And all the aim of all of my work is to draw people's attention to that. How do you cure an alcoholic? How do you cure a drunk? The first thing you must do is you must break through the denial. Break through the denial. Alcoholics are in denial. Their friends know that they're alcoholics. Their friends know that they have a problem. But the alcoholic doesn't. The alcoholic will say, I don't have a problem. I can quit whenever I like. I'm getting by. I'm still holding on to my job. I'm okay. As they sink and sink and sink and make more and more mistakes and fail to show up on time to events they're supposed to be at, and lose the respect of their colleagues. As these things happen, the drunk, the alcoholic, is in denial. This is how humans are. Rationality, the world of intelligence, the world of rationality is one thing, and the world of emotion and the world of sin, if you will, I think alcoholism is a sin, but you know, the extent to which one is guilty in God's eyes, that's debatable, because if you're not in control of your actions, it may well be that God does not hold us to the same standard as someone who is control of their actions. So, you know, that we don't know. But I do believe that acts of self-destruction and acts of destruction of others are sins. And if you don't like that terminology, they are mistakes, certainly. And we have to approach those sorts of problems. We have to approach the problems of alcoholism differently than we would approach a problem of solving a mathematical puzzle. They are not at all problems of the same nature. And the complication of stock investing is that stock investing is two very, very, very different things. Stock investing is half a mathematical puzzle. It is half learning how to most effectively earn your share of the economic productivity of the United States if you're a U.S. stock investor. That's all an intellectual puzzle, and that's where all, you know, 90% of the literature is focused. But the other half of the investing project is getting your emotions under control so that you learn about these things effectively, so that you don't go into denial and ignore the stuff you don't want to hear, but you actually take in the data and listen to its message. And that's a whole different breed of cat. That's an emotional issue, an emotional problem. And you have to use a different language for that. And the problem with stock investing is that people who come to believe that it's all an intellectual puzzle, they can't even hear the words of those who are bringing up the emotional issues. Valuations, I always say, valuations affect long-term returns. Valuations means people. Valuations is emotions. That's what valuations are. Emotions cause overvaluation, nothing else. Overvaluation is irrational. If you're trying to make investing an intellectual puzzle, You're leaving valuations out before you begin, because valuations are an emotional puzzle. There's nothing intellectual about them. They're counter-rational, counter-intellectual. So as I speak, October 20th, 2008, we've recently seen a huge stock crash. And people are concerned. And we've had a number of big name experts come out in different forums and say it's a mistake to panic. John Bogle has done this. Burton Malkiel has done this. Warren Buffett most recently. There's one guy who's saying otherwise, the guy on television. I don't think I can recall his name right off the top of my head, but there's a guy on television who sort of goes into histrionics about stocks. Kramer, James Kramer. He's saying, sell everything, get out, you know. He's going for the emotional jugular. Sell everything, get out. So he's not saying not to panic. He's saying, give in to those feelings of panic. So there's that, you know, there's some doing that, but most responsible people are saying don't panic. And I of course agree with the message don't panic. I'm much more in tune with Buffett and Bogle and Malkiel than I am with Jim Cramer. But I read their comments. I'm reading their comments from the standpoint of someone who believes in the rational investing model. And there's sort of a ghostly presence to these comments that disturbs me. And the ghostly presence is they're saying things that are accurate. They're saying stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition now. Panic's a bad thing. Stocks are offering better returns now than they did for years. They're saying these things that are true. But I can't help but wonder, how much do the people hearing this really believe it? How can you believe someone who tells you today stocks offer a better value proposition today than they have for 10 years, but during the 10 years wasn't telling you that you should lower your stock allocation? Aren't those ideas in conflict? If John Bogle comes out today and says, hey, buy stocks, or let's say Buffett, because I'm always picking on Bogle. Let's say Warren Buffett. Stocks offer a great, great long-term value proposition today, says Warren Buffett. That's true. But was Warren Buffett telling us to lower our stock allocations 12 months ago when stocks offered a horrible long-term value proposition? He was not. So, can the investor who has lost a large percentage of his life savings really put confidence in these words? There are two things going on today, two totally competing forces. We for the past 12 months, we've been shedding cotton candy. There's the cotton candy returns that are just based on emotion, and you know, that was most of the stock market, at least 50%, let's say 50% of the stock market price over the past 10 years. You were buying cotton candy, and then 50% was economic reality. The cotton candy has now been blown away. Now it's mostly economic reality. It's 80% real. So the value proposition is strong. The long-term value proposition is strong. But if you don't understand about the cotton candy, how do you know whether it is or not? How can you trust anything? This is what I don't like about passive investing, that it makes it impossible to understand the realities, because you're ignoring the emotional cotton candy aspect of investing. And then when the cotton candy gets blown away and you're left with economic realities, you're not able to have confidence in them, because all along you've been living a fantasy when it comes to understanding about what stock investing is. Now the word, and so while on the one hand I certainly want to tell people that the value proposition today is good, I also feel a need to tell people that on the three earlier occasions when passive/emotional investing became intensely popular and came to dominate all discussion of investing for a time, on those three earlier occasions, middle-class investors were wiped out, and the losses did not stop when we returned to fair value. The losses went far, far deeper than that, because investors had bought into these emotional strategies, the pure emotional strategies that today goes under the name passive investing. The idea that valuations don't matter, that you don't need to lower your stock allocation when prices go to insane levels. That idea has been popular four times in U.S. history. The first three, we saw wipeouts of the middle class, and we're now going through the fourth, and we've seen a partial wipeout. If we were to stabilize at today's prices, we could avoid any further damage, and I believe we would avoid a depression. But if we don't, if we continue down to the valuation levels we saw on the three earlier occasions when we tried this crazy idea, that would mean another 50% loss on top of what we've already seen. And I do think there's at least a chance that could lead to a depression. So why do it? I would like, you know, to the extent I can have any influence, and my influence is obviously limited, to the extent I can have any influence, I would like my influence to be to prevent that. I believe the key to preventing it is not further denial of the realities, which is what got us into trouble in the first place. I believe the key to preventing it is letting the sunshine in. Let's start talking about investing as if it's a serious subject, which it is. Let's start talking about the historical data, how stocks have always worked in the past. Let's start looking at what that tells us about whether our retirement plans are going to go bust in years to come. whether we can trust the information we hear when we turn to experts on the television or on the radio or on the in the newspapers. Do any of the numbers add up? Are the methodologies used in the studies that we're relying on analytically valid? Do they include adjustments for valuations? I want to let all that in. And I think that's healing. Letting it in is healing. It's upsetting in the short term to people who aren't aware of it. But it's ultimately healing. And it's not as upsetting now as it would have been a year ago, because if we were to talk about the realities a year ago, I think the big stumbling block was people would have to acknowledge that 50% of their money is cotton candy. It doesn't have any lasting economic significance. It's just a fiction. But today that's not true. Today we are at only a little over fair value. So the money you have in stocks today is real. It's real. And if I am going to complain when we go wildly above fair value in our stock prices, and I do, I've complained strongly about that, I think in fairness and in consistency, I should also complain when we go far below that. So I don't see it as at all a good thing if we go from fair value, roughly we are at fair value today, and we go down to absurdly low prices. A P10 value of 8 is absurdly low. That means that if the stock market is valued at X in fair terms, in real terms, we're valuing at 1/2 X. I think that's a terribly, terribly, terribly bad idea. It's an idea that could cause us to flirt with an economic depression. So let's give that up. Let's stop. Let's not go there. But I believe and I fear that that idea, the ideas that cause us to go to a P10 level of 10 of 8, those ideas are the passive investing, the passive / emotional investing ideas. The hyper emotional approach to investing that tells us we don't need to lower our stock allocations when prices get wildly out of control serves us ill when prices are high, because it causes stock crashes, which causes us to lose so many years of life savings. That same hyper-emotionalism causes us ill when prices go down to absurdly low levels. It's just two sides of a single coin. The answer, what we want, is not more emotional investing, not more passive investing. We want more rational investing. We want to get over being stock drunk. I'm going to give two examples of being stock drunk that I encountered just in the last couple of days over this weekend. One is, there's a fellow named Azanon, and he posts from time to time. There's a board I call the Goon Central board. It's owned by John Graney, and I've described it before on these podcasts. It's crazy. The whole concept is crazy, but John is the author of one of the old school studies, and he's very, very angry that we've discovered that the old school studies are analytically invalid and need to be corrected. And so John has set up this discussion board where all the normal rules are apply like we're in opposite world from Superman comics. And so only abusive posters are permitted. And if you post civilly, if you post reasonably, you're kicked off the board. And I'm the one exception, because I'm the one who discovered the errors in the old school studies. I'm permitted to participate. And then the other goon posters, ridicule me. This is the concept of the board. And I post there because while these people are goons on the surface, while they post abusively all the time, I know that they're not really goons. They're surface goons. You know, I know these people, not all of them, but I know John, and I know a good number of them from when they were posting constructively. They were, you know, some of them were wonderful posters. John was one of my favorite posters at the Motley Fool board back when it was a, you know, it was the number one successful board at Motley Fool at one time. And John and I built that together. So I, you know, I'm trying to appeal to the humanity of these people, trying to pull them from their goonishness. And we all have goonishness. You see, goonishness to me is sin. That's why, you know, I mentioned that word sin earlier in this podcast. You don't hear people talk about sin in the investing realm, but you'll hear it from me. Sin is a turning against life, a turning against love. Sin is self-destruction. Sin is destruction of others. That's sin. And when I call, you know, goonishness is sin. Goonishness is when you give in to that get-rich-quick impulse. You say, I'm gonna destroy myself. I'm going to put all my money in stocks at a time when they're overpriced, and I'm going to suffer horribly, and I'm not going to listen to anybody who tells me different. I'm going to block that out. That's, in my mind, that's sin. Okay, it's not, I don't know that it's officially a sin, you know, in the catechism or whatever, but this is how I think of sin. Any act of self-destruction is an act of sin. Any act of destruction of others. So we all have an inner goon. We all have this. I once believed in passive investing. I'm a sinner. I once believed in passive investing. And so I participate at this board. There are a number of reasons why I participate, but one is to pull these people up. And, you know, I'm sure many people look at it and they say, he's never going to pull these people up. But that's in a final sense, perhaps not. But there are many good moments, and I often link to this board from my website, and I'll give people a warning. I'll say, you know, put on your hip boots, you know, before you descend. But it might be worth checking it out because there's a lot of gold nuggets buried in the manure. And that's so. There's good stuff in some of those threads. 80% of it is just unbearable, unspeakable, stink. I call this place the stinkhole of the internet. But 20% are times when these goons, these humans who are pretending to be goons for a time because they want to quote-unquote defend their belief in passive investing, their humanity comes out. We can never overcome our humanity, you see? This is the key, I think, to avoiding a depression. Understanding this, what causes a depression is it's a cycle of negativity, and the negativity starts when we bid prices up to absurd, sick levels, and then the cycle gets stronger when we adopt an investing quote unquote philosophy to justify that. And the cycle gets worse as we tell our friends about it and pull more people in to the negative ideas. It gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And, you know, now we're at a stage where, okay, we've dropped, you know, we've had this big stock crash. But can it get worse? Yes. In economic terms, there's no reason for it to get worse today. But can it get worse? Yes. If we don't give up the negativity, we can make it worse. That's the message of this podcast. That's why I'm recording this podcast, to get that message on the record. We can make it worse. Don't think that because we're now at fair value, the bad times are over. It's up to us whether they're over or not. We can make it better. We can make it worse. And we make it worse by getting so depressed and so frustrated and so shameful and so guilt-ridden, that we deny our humanity even more. When an alcoholic is challenged, Say things get really bad. Say he loses his job. You would like to think that the alcoholic would say, okay, I've been in denial. My friends told me I had a problem. I said no. Now I've lost my job. This is objective proof that I have a problem. Time for the denial to come to an end. And some do respond that way. That's why I say there's hope. That's why I say I remain hopeful we will not go into a depression, because that certainly is a human response. But the other human response is to go even deeper into denial. And of course, part of the denial is guilt. The reason why the alcoholic is in denial is he can't bear to look at the destruction he's caused. He caused the loss of his job. Say earlier, when people were trying to tell him, say he let down his wife or he let down his kids. You know, he promised to be at his kid's birthday party and he got drunk and so he didn't show up. His kid was let down. And the man feels guilty, the alcoholic. Part of the reason when they come to him and they try to intervene and they say, you have a problem, you have to accept it. Part of the reason he's in denial is he doesn't want to deal with that. Just like the stock-drunk investor doesn't want to deal with the fact that his net worth isn't $100,000, it's $50,000. He's living a fiction. The passive investing model has told him the $100,000 is real. Treat it like real money. Include it in your plans for the future. And he knows that's wrong. His common sense tells him that's wrong. His common sense tells him money can't just be manufactured out of nothing. He knows, and he's ashamed. And so if you report to him the historical data, if you report to him how stocks have always performed from such levels, the defenses, the wall comes down. And the same is true with the alcoholic. But you have to break this cycle of guilt. Now, losing the job could break it. Let's say that our stock crash of the past 12 months, an $8 trillion loss, in terms of an individual, that's equivalent to the loss of a job. It's very scary. It's very real. It could be the thing that would pull us up. It could be the thing that would bring us to what they call capitulation, where prices would stop going down. We would stop the negative cycle. We would let in reality, the reality principle, and then we would start investing rationally once again. But losing the job doesn't always cause the alcoholic to start up. That can cause even stronger denial, because he now has shame not only over missing, you know, his son's birthday party, he's got shame about losing his job. The shame has been multiplied. So if the loss he suffers, if the pain he suffers is not great enough to cause him to break through the denial can get worse. Instead of getting better, it can get worse, because there's more guilt, there's more sin, there's more goonishness. So what you see at this board is a lot of ugliness. But you also see the alcoholic struggling with the reality principle. And you will see individual posters there. They will put up little thoughts about, well, what about this, Rob? And sometimes, you know, I can't always tell if they're sincere or not, but sometimes I think they are. And when they are sincere, I do my best to respond. I do my best to help out. And I feel that helps me, because it helps me sharpen my thinking. I'm dealing with people who are not supporters of mine. So they're trying the hardest they can to punch holes in the rational investing model. And so they force me, they keep me honest as well. But there's a poster there named Azanon, and he had posted before. And he has a lot of interest in the valuation-informed indexing approach to investing. So he's on substance issues, he's a supporter of mine. He would like all the boards to be opened up to discussion of what the historical data says, and you know, how PE10 can be used as an effective tool, these sorts of things. But he made a pitch to me, and he said, I don't know, he called it a suggestion for Rob or something like that, and he was saying, Rob, before we talk about anything else, you need to read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, Rob, you irritate people. I don't recall the exact words, but that was the idea. You're obnoxious. That's what he was saying. He's saying, Rob, you're obnoxious. You know, there's no hope that you're ever going to be permitted on these boards so long as you are as obnoxious as you are today. He got specific. This was the particularly great thing. Other people have said that you're obnoxious, and it leaves me with nothing, because I say, well, you know, how am I obnoxious? And usually the answer is, you know, oh, if you don't know, we're not going to tell you. And so, you know, there's nothing for me to fasten onto. There's nothing for me to respond to. But he did give a particular example that I felt was enlightening. He says, Rob, you don't have to, if you see that Bogle got something wrong, you don't have to point that out. Just say what's right. Don't say what's wrong. And I've heard this from other people. I think that fellow, Wayne, I think his name was, that put the letter to the editor at John Russell's site a week or two ago, was saying something along those lines. When he said, Rob is wounded. Rob sounds wounded in his podcast. I think that's the same idea. Rob, talk about what works. Talk about rational investing. Talk about valuation-informed indexing. Talk about PE10. Ignore any mistakes Bogle made. Ignore any flaws in the passive investing model. Ignore the errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. Why do you have to talk about that stuff? Well, my answer is, I'll tell you my answer, it's that I would love to only talk about the positive stuff. Nothing would make me happier. And I've seen that, I know that many people are interested in hearing, and many people who want nothing to do with me if I talk about the flaws of passive investing, they flock around me if I talk only about the positive. So there's a lot of truth in what these people are saying. Azanon hit on something very important. The trouble is, if I were to go to some discussion board and talk about valuation-informed indexing, within 10 minutes, someone's going to come along and they're going to say, but Rob, timing doesn't work. Don't you know that? Timing doesn't work. See, that's passive investing. And now I'm in a corner. If I can ignore the question and just keep positive, but I don't think that's right. The person deserves an answer to their question. It's a perfectly reasonable question. We've all been told 1,000 times timing doesn't work. So the person, you know, the question is a serious question. But if I answer the question, it's very hard to answer it, because the answer for why timing works is so painfully obvious. Obviously, there are some forms of timing that don't work. But long-term timing, what I recommend, has to work. All it is looking at the value proposition of stocks and buying more when the value proposition is good and buying less when the value proposition is poor. How could that not work? It's like saying when a car is valued at $20,000, you should buy it at $20,000 or less and be less inclined to buy it at $30,000. How could that not work? It's almost an insult to explain why it works. It's so obvious. But of course, most people don't believe it. They don't believe it because they've been saturated in the passive investing model. When people hear the timing doesn't work 10,000 times over the course of 30 years by lots of big name experts, highly educated, highly experienced people, they come to believe it's true. What would you expect? So the problem with promoting a rational approach to investing is making the positive case for it is a piece of apple pie. There's nothing to it. But the struggle is overcoming the negativity that is brought to the table when people refer to the passive investing marketing slogans. That's where all the trouble comes in. And once I mention that passive investing is flawed to the core, and that, you know, the passive investing ideas don't match up with the historical data and all this, then we're off to the races. Then you've got the abusive posting again. So I don't think Azanon's idea is a practical one, but I applaud him for saying what he thinks. I applaud him for getting the issue on the table, and I think he represents a lot of people. So my real market, the people I'm trying to reach, are people like Azanon, people who know, people who understand, people who are not as opposed to passive investing as I am, do not have passive investing is the enemy of the middle class investor. Most people don't believe that. So people who don't believe that, but yet are open to the idea of hearing a different way. And I have come to the conclusion that the only way to get us from where we are to where we want to be is to defeat this monster, to get on the table all the things wrong with passive investing, all the things wrong with alcoholism. You see, let's return to that stock drunk theme. How do you get a drunk to admit that he's a drunk? Do you get it by sort of gingerly, tentatively saying, oh, you know, didn't you used to do better at your job? Didn't you used to be always, you know, making your appointments on time, and now you're not? Well, the person's an alcoholic. His defenses are so strong. He comes up with an answer to that one in 2 seconds flat. Well, yeah, but my boss, the new boss is all bad. The new boss is unfair. Never tells me the time. I'm busier now. I don't have... They can come up with a million excuses. So I don't think you're going to get anywhere with that. That's called enabling. I think that to help someone overcome alcoholism, you have to be direct. You have to say... You do have to be kind. You have to be charitable. You have to say, you are my friend. I love you, man. But you are an alcoholic. You need help. You need to be direct. You need to be firm. You need to be strong. That's the policy that I try to follow. I try to be firm in saying, the safe withdrawal rates aren't a little bit wrong. They're wildly wrong, the safe withdrawal rate studies. They need to be fixed. This is, you know, tough love. But, you know, and then the compassion, you know, has to come in. But there has to be firmness. And the stakes are high. What we're talking about in this podcast is the possibility has been broached that we could be heading into a depression. And something I think very much needs to be pointed out is a lot of people are in sort of a state of anxiety today. And I think what a lot of people are going to do is they're going to read these articles about a depression, and then they're going to, you know, for a month or two. And then something else will be in the news, and their attention will sort of wander. Maybe prices will go up a little bit. That'll give them some relief. Stock prices will go up a bit. Well, the risk of this, you know, of this depression risk, it's not going to go away in 2 months or 3 months. It could take 5 or 6 years before we get there. It could be that we're going to see it on the bad scenario. I don't at all want to lead you to believe that there's only a bad scenario. There's a good scenario. The good scenario is we could stabilize at this price level, and we could continue earning 6.5% real returns for a long time into the future. There's no economic reason why that cannot happen today, as there was a year ago. There is not today. But the bad scenario is we grind lower and lower, year by year, 5 years, 6 years, and then the spirit of the investor is broken. And, you know, that's called depression. That's what we don't want to see happen. And I believe the way out of that scenario is information. The way I deal with, when I have anxieties, maybe not everyone's like this, but say you have a sickness. You always hear about people, they have a sickness, and the doctor will say, I'm not going to tell you. You know, because I don't want to upset you. I want to know. And My experience with people is people adapt to amazing things. You give them bad news, you know, you tell somebody you're going to be in a wheelchair for life. And I just feel, oh, if that happened to me, I just don't know how I could go on. I couldn't bear it. I couldn't accept it. But the reality is, if you're the one it's happened to and you have to accept it, somehow you do. But I don't think you can accept it by going into the denial about it. I think, you know, I think it's a healthy thing when people in that sort of situation, they get, you know, they get some therapy. And the goal of the therapy should be getting these things out on the table where you can cope with them. I don't think the therapist would be a good therapist if he said, you're not really in a wheelchair, or you're in a wheelchair today, but you'll be getting out in a few months, if it's not true. In other words, part of the therapeutic process, if it's to succeed, is to be rooted in the reality principle. So what we should be telling people today is not, oh, you know, stocks might go back up to where they were a year ago. All that would do is keep those feelings of denial alive, those negative, poisonous feelings, the things we need to overcome. What we want to do is say no. We want to say no, that's not going to happen. That was a fantasy. That was a fiction. That was a lie. That's not going to happen. But here's how investing works in the real world. And I think we can cope. I think humans have a great capacity to accept reality when they know it. So the way we deal with fears is not by hiding the realities. We provide as much of the true story as we can possibly get out to people. The magic of that is you'll go through a painful experience taking in the realities. That's unavoidable. But once you've taken them in, the next morning you wake up and you're not afraid anymore because you've already seen the worst. And what happens is human nature is to start to look forward rather than backward. So each day gets a little better. And you get to a point where you're never going to get to a point where you're going to say, I'm glad I'm in a wheelchair. But you get to a point where you say, I'm dealing with things. I can take a punch. Life is worth living. I have friends. I have work I do. I have people I love. Life is worth living. And, you know, of course, there are these stories where people do just amazing things. My wife told me a story that blew my mind about a guy that, and these stories scare me. I like to body surf when we go to the beach. And it's not always a good thing when you get older because your body is not as flexible. And I've heard stories of people who break their neck and they're paralyzed. And there was a sad story of a man who did that. You know, he went body surfing and he was probably my age and he became paralyzed for life. And he was in a wheelchair but he somehow, you know, he got over it and he became a painter and he learned how to, you know, move the brush. Like, I think he learned how to move the brush with his toes. This is what my wife told me. He could move his feet, not his hands. And he became a famous, recognized painter. I mean, not, you know, he's not hugely famous, but relatively famous. I mean, he achieved success. How do you even accept that someone can do something like that? That's so wonderful and so amazing. But that's, you know, that's humans for you. That's what they're capable of. So it's all about making our energy positive. And you can't get to the positive stuff until you face the nasty poison stuff. That's how you put it behind you. So I don't agree with Azanon that the answer is to ignore the negative stuff. I certainly think it would be a mistake to become obsessed with it. But I don't at all think the answer is to ignore it. I have always believed that the answer is to talk about the elephant in the living room. When you have a friend that's an alcoholic, you have to be kind. You know, you don't insult him when friends are around. But you take him aside and you say, look, man, You know, we go back a long time. You have a problem. And don't make excuses, because I know you too well. There's a great song by Marshall Crenshaw. Stop doing that. Stop doing that. It's on the Life's Too Short album. And he talks about a friend who's abusing drugs. And he says, it used to be all about fun and self-discovery. But now, you know, what I see is just you going down. Stop doing that. Stop doing that. That's what we need to be telling passive investors today. Stop pretending. Stop the lies. Stop doing that. Stop saying, oh, we're just going to make it all up. Stop saying that it's possible to know how to invest effectively without considering valuations. Stop doing that. That's what caused the crash. So stop it. The other event over the weekend is Michael Kitsis. And Michael Kitsis is a friend of mine. I'm going to start with that. Michael Kitsis is a financial planner, and I've exchanged emails with him. He did a study on safe withdrawal rates that went halfway to where we need to have things go. He showed in his study that the safe withdrawal rate is not a constant number, like the old school studies say. The old school studies say it's always 4%. John Walter Russell's research shows that's not so. The safe withdrawal rate can go as low as 2% or as high as 9%, depending on the valuation level that applies on the starting date of the retirement. Michael Kitsis put out a study, sometime earlier this year, saying that the safe withdrawal rate can indeed go higher than 4%, which is true. So that's valuable research. That's going to get a lot of people thinking about how valuations affect long-term returns, and that's what we need to get over this sickness. But Michael, he's half new school. He's half old school. And so he sort of failed to point out that that valuations also can make the safe withdrawal rate go lower than 4%. There are times when it's not 4%, it's 3%. There are times when it's not 3%, it's 2%. That's the other side of the story. And that's why we're going to see millions of busted retirements in days to come, in the event that stocks perform in the future anything at all as they've always performed in the past. All of this financial ruin that has been caused by our acceptance of this crazy passive investing model. So I had a lot of email correspondence with Michael, and I published it at the blog. You can check it out. I would check it out if I were you. I think there's good stuff. Good stuff in Michael's emails and good stuff in my emails. Taking, somewhat different perspectives. There's a lot we agree on, some things we don't agree on. But it's a good back and forth. But Michael, I'd be interested to know how he happened to see this, but he saw one of the posts that I put at the Goon Squad board. It was actually the post on the Asinine thread. I think it went up Saturday, and I said, I don't know, I can't give you the precise wording, but I said Michael, I was talking about how Bogle does good and bad. You know, Asinine had brought up Bogle, and then I was talking about how others have done the same thing. And I said Michael Kitsis has said something along the lines of he understands that the old school studies are going to cause financial harm, but he is reluctant to do too much to warn people about it because he doesn't want to disrespect the authors of those studies. I think that's a fair statement of Michael's position. It's not a quote. It's a summary of what he said in his emails to me. Michael has clearly understands that valuations affect long-term returns. There's no question whatsoever. He understands there are problems with the old-school studies. He can go that far. But he's not able to say the old-school studies are analytically invalid, the old-school studies get the numbers wrong, the old-school studies need to be corrected. That Michael has not done. And I asked him why. I'd like, you know, he has some influence. He could, he's moderating a conference where some of these, the authors of the old school studies are going to be participating. I don't know, in October, November, I think November. And, you know, I told him, I said, I'd be happy to speak and I can ask these people, can we, you know, can you help us get publicity out so we can tell people that relied on these studies that they can change their retirement plans before their retirements go bust. Let's get the word out. I've been trying to get the word out on this for 6 years. You know, I've tried everything I can think of. And that's where he said, no, you know, I don't want to disrespect the old school authors. And then he goes into a thing where he says they get the historical surviving withdrawal rate correct. You know, and of course, that's never been questioned. Everyone knows that. But that has nothing to do with whether the withdrawal rate they identify as safe is indeed safe, and the historical data shows it is not. When you look, when you use an analytically valid study, one that includes the effect evaluations, you see that at the top of the bubble, that 4% withdrawal rate for a high stock portfolio, that retirement portfolio had only a 30% chance of surviving 30 years. That's not safe. So those, you know, the studies are wrong. So, I don't know. Michael sent me an email. He sent it Saturday night, and I read it Sunday morning. And I hope that he's going to give me permission to post it at my site. Then you'll be able to read it, because he's being critical of me. He's saying, Rob, you're misquoting me. You're being unfair to me. And I don't think that's so, but I'd like you to read Michael's words so that you can, you know, read his own precise words and decide for yourself. And then I wrote a response to Michael Sunday morning, and I will be posting my response. If I get permission, I will post Michael's email as well. But, you know, again, it never ceases to amaze me how powerful a force emotion is in Investo world. Michael is a great guy. He's warm in his comments. He takes time out of his day to you know, to craft these emails that end up helping educate us all. He's done good research. He's told me he's going to do additional research on the safe withdrawal rate, and I think he's indicated some of that research is going to show. What did he say? He was going to show that changing your stock allocation, the benefit of timing the market in retirement. He was looking at John Walter Russell's research on. You know, John Walter Russell used to call it switching instead of timing, but shift, you know, switching your stock allocation as a way of improving your return while lowering your risk, getting better results. And Michael is doing research that is going to show that. And that's, you know, great. It's great. And Michael did a blog post at his blog. Very complimentary of me, very kind. He referred to our retirement risk evaluator calculator. I think he called it a wonderful calculator, I think. I know the adjective was very positive. I'm not sure. He said fantastic or wonderful, but, you know, very kind words. And of course, if I am in some way being unfair to him, I of course want to correct that. The last thing I want to do is to be unfair to Michael Kitsis. You know, that would just be tragic. What possible constructive purpose would be served by being unfair to this individual who has helped me and helped all of us, helped the entire community? Who, you know, I'd like him to be our advocate. My goal is to get him working harder to share what we've learned. He's troubled by what I said. I don't think there's any question about that. So I wrote an email, and I hope that he'll understand the points, but I don't know. You know, we'll see. I mean, by the time you hear this podcast, it may be that we've had correspondence. I don't know. But what I believe is happening is that I say one thing, but it's heard as something else. And that's why, you know, as Anon, he hears what I'm saying. He says, Rob is obnoxious. Is it obnoxious to tell people that the numbers you used for your retirement are wrong and that your retirement is going to fail unless you lower your stock allocation in time? Is that obnoxious? See, I see that as my job. I don't see it as obnoxious. And in the case of Michael, I applaud him for many good things he's done. But I have an obligation. I suppose Azanon would say you should applaud Michael when he does great, and you should ignore anything you think doesn't make sense. Just like, you know, he told me to do with Bogle, and many have told me to do with Grainy. I just can't see it, because in my mind, I have an obligation to my readers to help them understand why. We've known about the analytical errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies dating back to May 2002. That's when I put my post at the Motley Fool board. That's when John Walter Russell started his research. May 2002, over 6 years. And none of these studies have been corrected to this day. And arguably, the quote-unquote experts knew about these errors even before May 2002. Scott Burns told me he knew about research showing that valuations affect long-term returns that went back decades to the 1980s. So, you know, but it's Scott Burns. He was annoyed with me. He didn't use the word obnoxious. He said your approach is catastrophically unproductive. That's the same thing. He's saying I'm obnoxious. It's the same story over and over again. But my take is, if you knew about this research in the 1980s, why didn't you write the column telling people that safe withdrawal rates, the old safe withdrawal rate studies that don't include evaluation adjustment, are analytically invalid? Why was it left to Rob Bennett to do that? Some guy who posts on discussion boards. Why didn't Scott Burns do it? And I can't answer that question other than to come back to my old standby. Investing is a highly emotional endeavor. And emotion trumps intelligence. You can be as intelligent as all get out. And if you emotionally can't accept the realities, your intelligence is going to be thwarted. It's not going to evidence itself in your investing advice. So that, to me, is the whole story. That's what we need to be talking about. And we need to do it in charity, but we need to do it with firmness and with resolve, the same way we would deal with an alcoholic. With charity, but with firmness and resolve. And the stakes are high, because I was making this speech a year ago, but the people who believe in passive investing, well, some of them were saying it was impossible that we would ever go these valuation levels. I remember Schroeder telling me that it's impossible that we could ever return to fair value. But now we have. So it wasn't impossible. And there's so much good in that, because it means we can go forward without having to worry about further losses. But it's scary if we don't get the message. If losing our job causes us to give up self-denial, to break through that self-denial, then we have bright days ahead as stock investors. And also in the economy, you know, if we fix the stock market, I think that can go a long ways to fixing the economy as well. But if we continue in denial, we could go down a long ways yet. We could go down another 50%, and it won't necessarily happen in 6 months or a year. It could grind out over 5 or 6 years. It could be a painful 5 years ahead of us. And we have the power to decide that. Can we give up the drink? The drink is the idea that valuations don't matter, that emotions don't matter. The drink makes us feel good temporarily. The drink hurts us in the long run. So let's take this opportunity where we've been shaken up, to acknowledge that the drink has hurt us, and to accept all the bad that's been done, and then to accept it and then to start looking forward instead of backward. I think that's the key to overcoming this specter of depression that we're hearing about. And I think that's what's lacking in the speeches we hear by Bogle and McHale and Buffett. I don't advise them to go to the Cramer route, urging panic, but I do advise them to go the route of balance, emotional balance, where they say, yes, the value proposition is strong today, but we were wrong about what we said when we said valuations didn't matter, that you don't need to lower your stock allocation when prices get high, because then the message becomes believable. And then we're dealing with reality. We're accepting the reality principle, and that's what gives us confidence to go forward. That's what gives us optimism for the future. That's what helps us to stop looking back at our sins, at our ugly, nasty, smelly, dirty sins, and instead look forward to all the good times we can have in the future, learning about how stock investing works and enjoying much higher returns at much lower levels of risk. Let's work together to stop the next depression. Depression is over if you want it. Remember that billboard John Lennon had? War is over if you want it. Well, that applies to economic depression. Economic depression is over if you want it. Good luck with your investing strategy.